You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and welcoming you on Thursday, April the 16th, after a weekend when Wout van Aert's tears of joy cleansed the shame brought upon the nation of Belgium by Remco Evenepoel's lies, which we'll be discussing again at great length today. I'm joking. My name's Daniel Freeman and I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we'll be unreservedly lauding van Aert's victory in Paris-Roubaix and singing, I'm afraid we will literally be singing, the praises of another star of the last few days. The other members of the supergroup today, the Cycling Podcast supergroup, are our friend in high places, because he is at altitude. It's the Motown maestro, lucky Larry Warbass.
Hey, guys.
Larry. Tudor Pro Cycling's Larry Warbass. I was speaking to the team at the weekend, Larry. They're very happy with your appearances on the Cycling Podcast. And also on drums, or maybe harmonica, it's the troubadour of not Watford, Lionel Burney.
Yeah, tambourine maybe.
I didn't know whether is that an insult? Was that an insult? I was worried about that might be an insult. What? The harmonica was that might be some sort of euphemism for not doing very much. I don't know.
I think isn't the harmonica quite a difficult instrument to play?
It is. Yeah, it is. I mean, I thought you'd be the perfect man for that.
I'm more tambourine.
You are in not Watford, you're at very low altitude, I would suggest, Lionel. And Larry, you seem to be, you look as though you're in a log cabin.
Yeah, we're in an apartment at altitude. It's actually quite a nice one. It's like fully remodeled. It's probably the nicest one I've stayed in up here in Sierra Nevada. So yeah, we're lucky because we have a pretty good setup with the team. We're not staying in the sports center, also known as the car, which is next door. But we have, yeah, an apartment. We each have our own room. We have a chef, coach, mechanic, soigneur. So it's a pretty good setup here.
You look as though you're currently lying on, it might be the top bunk.
No, actually, I am not in a bunk, but there is a bunk bed next to me in case you guys want to come visit. I have two spare beds in my room. So three beds here.
Larry, marginal gains, you should be sleeping on that top bunk, son. That's another meter of altitude. This reminds me of the last mountain stage of the Tour de France last year. We were starting in Albertville and it was a key day for Oscar Onley, and the picnic post NL bus had parked up about an hour before any of the other buses. And I asked someone at the team why they were so early, and they said we wanted to get down from altitude as early as possible for the marginal gains of not having a further hour at altitude, which might affect recovery. So who knows, that bunk bed, that could be the difference, Larry, between you winning a stage at the Tour of the Alps and not.
Unfortunately, I don't think that bed's going to make a difference.
Well, Larry, talking of roommates, there was something I wanted to ask you about, and that is a former roommate, short-lived, we've talked about this on the Cycling Podcast before, very short-lived flatmate of yours, has been in the news the last couple of days, a compatriot of yours, Taylor Finney. Now, you did share a home or flat with him in Tuscany many, many years ago. Of course, he's been retired from the Pro Peloton for a few years, but it didn't escape my attention this week, because I'm a very attentive observer of all matters track cycling, that he's making a comeback on the track. Tell us about it.
I actually have to say I was shocked. I didn't expect that, you know. So I know he's been enjoying his life just not being a bike racer. He's gotten into painting, among other pursuits. Cycling has not totally been on his radar, other than just, I don't know, pedaling around for fun. Racing, I thought, was kind of like the last thing that he would want to do. But, you know, I think it's kind of cool and I'm excited for him to see how it's going to go. But, you know, I was mentioning off air that, you know, I think he'll be very good because yeah, he's a former individual pursuit world champion. I honestly think he'll be a big asset to the U.S. team pursuit team. So I think that's pretty cool. And I think that'll probably give them a bit of the motivation they need to try to go to the Olympic. I mean, I think it's kind of a cool news and, you know, maybe nice for him to have something to shoot for.
And kind of there's a family link as well, isn't there? Bringing the Finney family relationship with the Olympics and cycling and Los Angeles round in full circle, because Taylor Finney's mother Connie Carpenter Finney, as she is now, but Connie Carpenter, as she was in 1984, won the gold medal when, well, that was the first women's road race at the Olympic Games in 84, Los Angeles. You probably don't remember that, Larry. Well, no, you can't remember that, Larry.
No, I don't. But I did see, I'm aware of that statistic. And I'm sure she'll be pumped that he's coming back racing, because I know she's really, really into it. And, you know, she was a big supporter of him during his career before. So I'm sure she will be really excited to see that he's getting back on the track and, yeah, going for it.
Well, talking of LA and talking of things going full circle, Larry, it didn't escape my notice either that you slid into the comments of an illustrious LA, I presume he's an LA resident, but he certainly plays for their basketball team. LeBron James caused quite a stir last week by recording a video, a good luck video for Mathieu van der Poel before Paris-Roubaix. And who was top of the list of comments on the post, certainly on my algorithm anyway? Larry Warbass. Yes.
I don't think I was top of the comments list in other people's, but yeah, no, I just thought it was cool.
What did you comment again? Way to go, LeBron. We love you, man.
No, I just said haters will say it's AI, because I just thought it was cool that LeBron was talking about cycling, even if he was reading off of a teleprompter or phone or something. But
get out,
you know, I mean, I'm sure he doesn't know who Van der Poel is, and I'm sure he doesn't know what Paris-Roubaix is, but he's a big investor in Canyon. I just think it's kind of cool that you know, one of the biggest sport people in the world gets a little involved in cycling. So
one of the biggest, literally. There was more crossover, that's not an Allen Iverson reference. There was more crossover content, basketball, cycling content, which I saw on Instagram. I don't know, maybe this is an old clip, but I saw video of Reggie Miller, famously of the Indiana Pacers many years ago, and with Wout van Aert this winter. Larry, you were telling us before we started recording that Wout van Aert was there, of course, the winner of Paris-Roubaix at the weekend. He was there in the winter for what purpose? It was for Red Bull.
Yeah, I think he was doing something with Red Bull because it's one of his sponsors. And then, yeah, he ended up playing basketball with Reggie Miller. And, well, we could say playing basketball. He was definitely not playing basketball. He had a basketball in his hand and missed a lot of shots. So, yeah. He was on a basketball court with Reggie Miller and a guy named Lethal Shooter on Instagram, who's kind of like a basketball influencer. So I thought that was pretty cool because I used to be a big basketball fan when I was younger.
Who would make up a basketball, an NBA themed team pursuit quartet? If we've got LeBron James, Reggie Miller, what about Tony Parker? Grew up in France, of course, big cycling fan. I think rode with one of the French teams on a rest day at the Tour de France a few years ago. I remember that happening.
Tony Parker, he also presented Mark Cavendish with a special jersey on the morning of Mark Cavendish's last stage at the Tour de France in Nice, if I'm not mistaken.
So we just need one more. Throw it over to the listeners, I think.
What next? Michael Jordan, I don't know. What could Michael Jordan be doing?
More chance of them being successful at the cycling, I think, than the cyclists putting together a five-person basketball team. I've just got images of the ball like bouncing off the backboard and into the front row of the spectators.
If they even hit the backboard, you know?
No, not enough upper body strength for a start, I think. You know, sort of spindly arms trying to throw quite a heavy ball.
Chaps, since we mentioned Reggie Miller, and he does have a genuine long-standing interest with in professional cycling, a great sports documentary, if you've not seen the 30-30 ESPN, I think it's called Miller Time, Reggie Miller and the New York Knicks. He sort of had a historic rivalry with that particular franchise, Larry, as you would call it. That's very much worth watching.
Should we talk about some cycling?
No, let's talk about Remco and his lies. Larry, this didn't go down.
Let it go.
This didn't go down too well last week with everyone. We spent 45 minutes talking about Remco and his lies, but no more. None of that this week.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Indeed Sponsored Jobs. If you're looking to bolster your team, strengthen your lineup, Indeed Sponsored Jobs is just what you need. You'll stop struggling to get your job advert seen because Sponsored Jobs will propel you ahead of the crowd, get you out in front, to attract all of the best quality candidates who fit your requirements. Sponsored jobs will boost your post, meaning that you can reach the people that are best qualified for your organisation with the right skills and experience that you're looking for. It makes a big difference too. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 90% more likely to report a top quality hire than non-sponsored jobs. So join the 1.6 million companies that sponsor their jobs with Indeed. As you listen to the Cycling Podcast, you can get a £100 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at indeed.com/cycle. That will help you to spend more time interviewing the candidates, the ones that really tick all of your boxes. There's less stress, less time spent, and better results with Indeed sponsored jobs. So go to indeed.com/cycle right now and support the Cycling Podcast by saying you heard about Indeed on the show. Indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. If you're hiring, do it the right way with Indeed.
4 days on, 4 days. Yeah, it is 4 days on from Wout van Aert's very emotional victory at the weekend in Paris-Roubaix. That's been the biggest story, I would suggest, of the week in professional cycling. There was another big story, certainly at the weekend, which we'll discuss later. But it certainly seems to have been a race that very much captured the imagination. People are talking about it. And Lionel, we had this debate to a certain extent, or we touched on it in Paris-Roubaix at the weekend, of where this ranked in great editions of Paris-Roubaix. People have also talked about it as one of the most emotional victories in Paris-Roubaix. Wout van Aert, we talked about the sort of redemption arc of Wout van Aert, all the injuries and all the misfortune he suffered. We talked about that in Paris-Roubaix. Lionel, one thing we missed, or we meant to mention, didn't we, was who he dedicated, or who he was going to dedicate the victory to. And that was also a very sort of heart-rending aspect of this.
Yeah, we didn't go into this because I wasn't entirely sure on Sunday evening the significance of Wout van Aert pointing to the sky as he crossed the line, winning Paris-Roubaix. It was then apparent that he was paying tribute to his former teammate, Michael Goulaerts, who died in the 2018 edition of Paris-Roubaix. They were teammates on the Verandas Willems-Crelan team. It was Wout van Aert's first ride at Paris-Roubaix, and he finished a very impressive 13th for a debutant that day. But of course, completely overshadowed by the death of his teammate. That, you know, just added to the significance, the emotional significance of the victory for van Aert.
Indeed. And well, as I said, certainly this was a victory that was very emotionally received, particularly in Belgium, internationally, but particularly in Belgium. And we knew that one man who would be absolutely delighted that Wout van Aert had won on Sunday was going to be our faithful classics correspondent, veteran Het Nieuwsblad, former Het Nieuwsblad reporter, but still very much with his finger on the pulse. Of course, I'm talking about Hugo Corvitz, the star of Corvitz Corner. Over to Hugo now for his observations on Wout van Aert's victory in Hell of the North on Sunday.
Pay attention, Freebie. I don't need to explain to you what spontaneous celebrations took place all over our country on Sunday evening. Wout van Aert was already incredibly popular in Belgium, but this victory in Paris-Roubaix was so much more than a victory. It was a triumph over the fate he had been defying for years. It was a story of the beatable defeating the unbeatable. Many compatriots identify with Wout van Aert, and they admire him because, despite as many setbacks as major victories, he fights back time and again. Wout's career reads like a metaphor for life. There are those events where everyone remembers where they were when it happened. When Eddy Merckx won the Tour de France for the first time. When the King of Belgium died in Spain. When Wout van Aert finally sprinted from hell to heaven on his seventh attempt. Well, I was standing at the end of zone 17 from Hornet to Wandigny, waiting for the women to pass. About 10 of us were watching a tablet from the trunk of a car. An explosion of joy followed. The Italian press officer for the women's team, UAE ADQ, remarked that he had now been able to see with his own eyes how passionately the sport is experienced in Flanders. I myself got goosebumps from pure emotions. Immediately, images from 8 years ago flashed through my mind. The Thursday before his very first Paris-Roubaix, I stood all alone along the cobblestone section of the Moulin de Vertin. I saw the young Van Aert floating over the cobblestones. The hairs on my arms stood on end. I came home and told my wife that I had seen the new Roger de Vlaeminck. It didn't quite go that far. Although that passage was pure art, his back was so perfectly flat that you could place a serving tray full of beer glasses on it and at the end of the section, so to speak, take the tray full of beer off. The day after Dwars door Vlaanderen in de Waregem, I sent Wout a message. I wrote that after years, I had finally seen that typical back of his in Finalis again. The rest is history. Sunday made it clear once again that there are no certainties in hell. Just ask Mathieu van der Poel or Tadej Pogačar, who saw a streak of 7 victories come to an end. This was more than just a victory by an incorrigible character. That win was also a godsend for cycling, which was in danger of descending into predictability. This is also one of the reasons why Wout van Aert's sprint victory stirred up so much emotion across national borders. It was downright moving how Mathieu van der Poel stormed towards the sobbing Wout van Aert after the finish to give him a warm embrace, even though he saw his own dream of achieving 4 in a row shattered in Le Bois de Valers. Pogačar had no trouble admitting that the cobblestones belonged to Wout, even though he saw his own dream of winning all 5 monuments in the same year shattered. And so the 7 lean years for our country and the cobbled classics came to an end. It had been since Philippe Gilbert in the same hell that the Brabançon had resounded. Well, the cobbled classics are a thing of the past. And that was also the reason why Van Aert celebrated the victory in my backyard on Sunday evening with beer and fries. Brought by Happy Taste Fry Shop, which is located a little further down from the Blue Woods Hotel. It doesn't get more Belgian than this. On to the Brabantse Pijl.
Hugo and continues the to excel, surpass himself. And I knew he would have a cracking Corvitz Corner for us this week. And so he did. And Corvitz Corner, arguably a more iconic sporting corner, the Amen Corner, the Carrefour de l'Arbre, I would say, Lionel. Anyway. Larry, you were watching at the weekend from Sierra Nevada, I presume, with your teammates. Who's up there? Storichar? Michael Storr is up there?
Yep. Michael Storr, Florian Stork, Will Barda, and Matisse Rondel.
Okay. So what was the setup in the sort of common room all around an iPad?
We were watching TV in the common room, and we actually came up with a game to make the race more exciting was... You know, the problem is with fantasy leagues, it's kind of boring because it's like the same guys are always winning and everything. So we did the reverse fantasy league, which is you couldn't pick a rider who was ranked in the top 100. You could only pick a rider ranked outside the top 100. Best rider won plus best team. So we each picked 3 riders. My team was 2nd.
Huh. Ranked according to what?
Their finished placing.
Who was your team, Larry?
So the problem was all my top choices got picked before me because I was the 7th round draft pick, you know. So my team ended up being this Fritz Biesterboos guy on Picnic, Arjen Leivens on Astana. Actually, my other pick was the best out of the 3, I think, but I can't remember now. So anyway, it was a fun game, and that kept us pretty into it because we were really rooting for the guys that we picked, you know?
What did you call the team? The Warbass franchise.
Not quite.
Lionel, we need a US marketing guy back. Larry, well, give us your broad brushstroke observations on, I mean, first of all, I mean, how spectacular did you think this edition of Paris-Roubaix was? But also anything else that you would like to add to, as we've talked about, sort of a lot of excitement about this edition, but there were also a lot of interesting talking points. For example, the punctures, that was a big talking point. There was shenanigans with sort of neutral service cars and so on and so forth. What are your main sort of bullet points?
I would say, number one, the thing that I thought was pretty crazy was there was no breakaway. So, you know, that definitely changed the dynamic of the race because, you know, in the past, the breakaway always got pretty far into the race, and then there'd always be this period where like the leaders were catching the breakaway late in the race and everything. And then, you know, the problem is since there was no breakaway, that put a lot of guys out of the race from essentially the first cobble sector. So yeah, it was crazy high speeds. And, you know, I think now just the way racing's going in a race like that, there's so much stress. They almost don't want to let the chance for some teammates of the other big riders go on the break. So yeah, I think that was interesting. Then yeah, there was just an insane amount of flats, which I don't really know why. I don't know if it's because people are riding faster tires now rather than like more puncture resistant. Maybe you would think, you know, Tade rode such big tires that you would think that would be more resistant to punctures, but apparently not. The front one was 35 and the back was 32. I mean, the other thing was they did mention that like a lot of cobbles have been stolen. Apparently, like, I don't know, there was a lot of people had been stealing the cobbles before the race. So there were a lot of cobbles missing. So I don't know if that could have had an impact. And then the other thing I saw that I thought was interesting, I don't remember who said this, but I did read someone said that they thought perhaps because the speeds are so much higher now that guys have less time to sort of choose their lines.
John Degenkolb was certainly made that point. I don't know if that's who.
Oh, no, that's not who I saw. But from someone in the race, I would definitely take that a lot more. So I thought that was interesting. Then obviously there was a ton of chaos. It's not good, but I would say the only good thing about the bad luck is all of the leaders had bad luck, you know? It was just at differing times. Vanderpoel's chase was insane. Like the fact that he almost came back after being 2 minutes down and seemingly totally out of the race. Yeah, it was pretty interesting. I mean, it was an exciting race with a lot of chaos.
Just on, well, the tire issue, Larry. Well, first of all, we should establish your credentials in Paris-Roubaix because I missed this earlier. When we mentioned Taylor Finney, there's a link because I should have mentioned that Taylor Finney won the edition of Paris-Roubaix Juniors that you took part in. That was 2010.
I'd never took part in Paris-Roubaix Juniors.
Oh, well, according to Pro Cycling Stats, you did.
No, that was Paris-Roubaix under 23.
I was sorry, Paris-Roubaix under 23. Okay.
I wasn't planning to do the race. And we were sitting like in the kitchen of the national team house in Belgium the night before. And some guy, I don't know, was sick or something. So they're like, oh, do you want to do it? And I was like, okay, why not? You know, I guess I'll just try it out. And it didn't last very long.
And you haven't been back since. So on the tires, Larry, I mean, you haven't been doing Paris-Roubaix the last few years, but can you just summarize briefly what the evolution has been and over what sort of time scale? As I say, we've got to the end point or the present day. Pogacar using 35s on the back, and was it 35s on the back?
No, 35 on the front.
35 on the front. Talk about how this has changed a little bit.
Even, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago. I don't know, sometime around when Matt Heyman won, a little bit before maybe. You know, people would ride these like endurance bikes with a bunch of like comfort, you know, specialized, developed the Roubaix bike, which was like had suspension and all this stuff. You know, for a long time, they thought you couldn't ride carbon wheels on Roubaix because they thought they would not hold up. They wouldn't be robust enough. Before they had these crazy puncture resistant tires on like aluminum rims, even when all the bikes were like pretty modern, I would say. And then I don't know if it was maybe once sort of disc brakes came in or whatever, then they're like, okay, yeah, you can ride like carbon wheels. But still, you know, a lot of times they're riding these more comfortable bikes, you know, with more compliance, things like that. Then still with crazy, crazy puncture resistant tires and not that wide, maybe 25, maybe 28 or something. You know, like, they're like, oh, wow, 27, 28 tires. And, you know, it was probably a lot of tubulars because they thought, you know, that was also better.
I would say in the last few years, there's just been like this rapid development in tires, you know, say the last 4 years. Now it's like the wheels are getting wider, which is making it possible to ride like an aerodynamic combo between a super wide tire with a wide rim. So now, you know, it's like, I know our team rode actually gravel wheels from DT Swiss in the race, because then like with a super wide tire, it's like aerodynamically, the rims develop for a wide tire. But, you know, I think even, for example, Envy, which UAE rides, they already have wide wheels and they're already developed around wide tires. So they're surely not developed for 35s, but even a 32 is probably quite aero on their wheels. So it's just allowed people to ride way bigger tires with lower tire pressure. And I think that's why we've seen now in like these cobbled races. Before it was like, oh, you have to be a big guy, you know? Now we've seen that actually, because the tire technology has evolved so much, it doesn't really matter your size. Okay, you still need more absolute power because it's a flat race. So, you know, you're not going to see 60 kilo guys winning Roubaix, but Tade, 65, 66 kilos, like he's obviously up there because he has a lot of absolute power. Now with the new tire technology, he can be competitive, which I think like 10 years ago, a guy of his side, it would have been a lot harder.
This obviously incident, you talked about the bad luck that befell with the three big favorites, I suppose. Van Aert had his share, Van der Poel, of course, in the Arenberg Forest, and then Pogacar before that. There was this moment with the Shimano neutral service where he had the puncture and he didn't take a front wheel. Is that why? Because they probably didn't have 35s.
No, I don't think so. I think he just thought, I don't even know why. I mean, to be honest, he should have taken the wheel, I think. He just thought like, oh, it's going to be too slow to change the wheel. In the end, I think it would have been way more optimal to change the wheel. But what was interesting to me was like, actually, it looked like the spare bike fit him reasonably well. So I almost wonder if it was actually his measurements.
Do you know what? I listened to a podcast earlier today, a German podcast, Radio RTW. Max Walscheid gave a fantastic, he's one of the sort of hosts of the podcast, and he gave a sort of an hour and a half long account of his own race in really forensic detail. And he said this, that Shimano neutral service now on the cars in particular, they have essentially a Pogacar bike. So the best riders in the world have a sort of setup on a Shimano neutral service bike. And he thought that they did this according to either world rankings or world tour rankings. So he thought that the bike that Pogacar took was essentially set up specifically for him.
Okay, so yeah, that's what I was guessing. But I just thought because, like, you know, they ride Shimano. I thought, like, for sure there's a connection. And they're like, well, you know what? It's probably the most important guy in the race that if he has a problem, maybe they have a Pogacar bike and maybe they have a Vanderpool bike on there, you know? But I know, like, in the past at a race, I think when we had Michael Storr doing really well, one of our directors was friends with one of the Shimano neutral service people, and they actually like did one of the neutral bikes with the pedals that he used and put it on the roof. They just like did his measurements. So, you know, I think that definitely happens sometimes. And yeah, so that looked to be the case. So maybe he was like, okay, well, I know it's in my measurements, so I'm just going to take the bike and then it'll be easier to change the bike again once the team comes. But I don't know. I still think doing the wheel change would have been better.
There's been quite a lot of mirth about the Pogacar, the neutral service bike, and there was a quote where he likened it to a wheelbarrow. I actually thought he looked all right on that bike, and he was making up some decent ground. But then I've also heard people referring to the fact that I think we know that these are Canyon bikes. LeBron didn't mention this in his message for some reason, but about the fact that there may be old models of Canyon bikes.
They're definitely not aerodynamic. So it's like an older climbing bike. I think it was like the ultimate model or whatever. Not aero at all. So I would say like that's a huge disadvantage in a race like this. And I would assume that even if they had wider tires, they're probably pumped way too hard. I'm sure they're just like terrible to ride on hobbles, to be honest, especially compared to the setup that he had.
Just back to the kind of the tech and the evolution of tech at Paris-Roubaix, it is one of the races where we've seen a lot more experiments over the years. I mean, I remember back in the 90s, the suspension bikes to try and mitigate the jarring of the cobbles. Larry, you mentioned carbon wheels, and you're right. For a long time, it was thought that the carbon rims were far too rigid to survive on the cobbles. And I think Fabian Cancellara in 2010 was the first rider to win Paris-Roubaix on carbon wheels. But every year we kind of see things changing, and it does surprise me that teams unveil new tech specifically for Paris-Roubaix. I think one of the higher profile bits of equipment that was given a debut at this sort of level of competition, Lidl Trek had some kind of almost inner tube tyre liner type setup, which is supposed to be 100% puncture proof. But I think Paris-Roubaix probably proves that there's no such thing. And we kind of touched on this in our Arrivé episode, didn't we, Daniel? The trade-off of saving watts, being able to roll very quickly on the smooth, but also cope with the cobbles. The course of Paris-Roubaix is asking such a wide sort of variance in demands of the bikes and the riders, isn't it? You need to be quick on the smooth sections. You need to be quick on the cobbles. They're, of course, very different types of surface. And I suppose it surprises me slightly that the extent to which they've gone for the speed on over the ground, when the cost of a mechanical at the wrong time can completely outweigh the sort of the gains that you can make from just rolling a bit quicker. But of course, that's about saving energy, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is if you don't take those gains, you won't even be in the race these days. We had this conversation even at like training camp this year. Is like, now we would take the risk of puncturing way more than riding slow tires, because if you ride slow tires, you aren't in the race. You know, like, there's such a huge difference between slightly slower tires and fast tires. If you ride those, like even this year at Strade Bianche, we rode these puncture resistant tires. And I mean, after 30K, we had three guys left in the race. So in the end, you can't take that risk. The only risk that you can take is you ride fast stuff. And if you puncture, you puncture. But if you don't ride fast stuff, you're out of the race before it even starts.
I just wanted to mention as well, another thing I sort of forgot to talk about in Arrivé, talking about Pogacar and neutral service. Of course, he's had an interesting relationship with neutral service over the last 12 months or so, because there was that moment in the Tour de France last year in Toulouse where the Shimano neutral service guy, assistant, did a fantastic job in keeping him in the race, sort of rushing across the road and getting him back on his bike and putting his chain back on, so on and so forth. And also, just on Max Valscheid and talking about punctures, again, I suspect, we said it at the weekend, that every rider in Paris-Roubaix, every rider that finishes, has a really sort of checkered story of everything that's happened in their day. And there are probably some heroic stories that we'll never hear. But Max Valscheid punctured on the first cobbled sector, and then, by his own reckoning, he did about a 25 kilometer time trial to get back to the peloton. It was actually the sort of second half of the peloton at that point, because the peloton had split. And then Pogacar had his problem, and Valscheid just happened to see him at the right moment, so got back on Pogacar's wheel and got back up to the front peloton that way, and then managed to finish 11th. So a pretty extraordinary ride that won't have got too much attention. But as I say, I think there are probably quite a lot of stories like that.
He was going to actually be one of my top picks for my team, but someone else picked him before me. So,
well, we won't go through Paris-Roubaix again blow by blow, because we did that quite some length on Sunday, didn't we, Daniel? And of course, there was the Arrivé episode also for the women's race. But there, one thing that really kind of dominated the weekend was the fact that for the first time since the women's race was created in 2021, it was held on the same day as the men's race. When the race first came along, it was held on the Saturday with the men's race on the Sunday. This year, both races were held on the same day. And I mean, from my point of view, that was suboptimal, because it meant I was able to watch none of it on the day, because of course we were recording Arrivé when the women's race was finishing. And then, as a consequence of the two races clashing, there was only around 90 minutes of live TV pictures from the women's race. And of course, people who are invested and engaged in the women's racing are very disappointed not to get an opportunity to watch much more of the race as they would have done had it been held on a Saturday. And lots of debate about this in the latest episode of the Cycling Podcast Feminine, which is out now with Rose Manley, Denny Gray and Lizzie Banks. Personally, I thought it was a retrograde step because it sort of places the women's race sort of into the shadow of the men's race. But I do also understand, you know, the sort of commercial pressures of the doubling the cost of road closures, the political agreement to close all of the roads 2 days running. There is also the commercial aspect of the Sportive, which takes place on the Saturday. But of course, though, that Sportive event doesn't have a full road closure that a professional race requires. So it's a tricky one. One aspect that the Cycling Podcast Feminam team were not aware of when they were discussing the issue, but I think is worth mentioning, is that since they recorded the episode, the viewing figures for French TV have been reported by a French website called Pure Media. And I mean, it makes a case for holding the women's race on the same day as the men, and hoping to maintain the interest of people who've just sat and watched the men's race and keep them sticking around to watch the women's race. Last year, the women's race held on the Saturday had 1 million viewers in France. This year, it had 1.7 million viewers coming off the back of the men's race, which had 2.26 million viewers. Now, that's obviously a 70% increase in eyeballs watching the race. And I think this really highlights the difficulty that cycling has. What does it want? Does it want exposure or does it want engagement? Fans who are deeply invested want the opportunity to watch as much as possible. But is this a case of kind of, you know, inching forward on one front and then on the other, and trying to find what will deliver the best result overall for the sport? I think it's a really tricky one, and it's a subject that I'm going to try to return to in the coming month, just to look at the balance between the broadcasting of the races and what it is that cycling's trying to achieve, I guess.
We've talked a lot about that, haven't we, in the last few months. Why cycling? What is it trying to achieve? A lot to say on that, isn't there?
I think it's an interesting subject, isn't it? Because you know, the marketers would be delighted at a 70% increase in the number of people watching the race. But if you wanted to sit down and see exactly how the women's race unfolded, 90 minutes is not adequate to do that. And I think, you know, in our discussion about Remco Evenepoel's YouTube announcement of his participation in the Tour of Flanders, we kind of veered into this whole debate. And it's just something that's been fermenting in my mind, really, that cycling is the kind of ultimate long form sport, isn't it? And yet attention has to be grabbed by short form media. And so we're in this strange sort of situation where you're trying to attract people with TikTok videos and then persuading them to read Tolstoy's War and Peace. I kind of joked to you, Daniel, didn't I? I mean, full disclosure, I watched every minute of Paris-Roubaix on Sunday, the men's race, from start to finish. I couldn't take my eyes off it. It was absolutely gripping entertainment, even when nothing was happening. And yet I did find myself thinking, come on, kids, strap in, sit down, bring your snacks. There's just 4¾ hours to go. That's the great dichotomy of what professional cycling is in this era of supposedly shortening attention spans. I noticed that the chairman and owner of Napoli Football Club is proposing that football matches be cut down to 25 minutes each half from 45 minutes each half to kind of cope with this. My final kind of point on this is that I think it's less about attention spans and age. I think it's more about types of people. Cycling appeals to types of people. I think you have to expose people to things and hope that they're attracted by something. This analogy may not work too well, but you know, when I was 12 years old, I didn't like coriander, or cilantro, I think you call it over there in the US. But then I grew to love it. And I think cycling is a sort of coriander of sports, isn't it? You've got to kind of mature a little bit before you can understand the interest and the nuance. And so it's much less about age. It's about whether or not the sport speaks to you on a certain level. And I think that, you know, Whiz Pop sort of appealing to people who haven't got the attention span to watch the last 50 kilometers of O Gran Camino on a Thursday afternoon is sort of a waste of energy. I think the whole problem has to be looked at from a different angle. Anyway, to be discussed.
Well, unless Larry's got something to add, have I got good news for you, Lionel, because you're going to get the whole of the tour of the Basque Country, Itzulia, in about 5+ minutes right now.
He's playing a little bit, he's enjoying, but the rest, we need to sweat a lot.
When you have those legs, I think it's easier than what people can expect.
But he should just enjoy it now.
Ultima cosa, last thing, what do you think of Paul Sexas?
I think that it's incredible.
Day five of the Tour of the Basque Country. We're in Eibar this morning, all of today in fact. This is the sort of beating, throbbing heart of cycling in the Basque Country. This curious little town, about 20 seconds behind, maybe a bit more. We've got, I can see Ricky Tello pacing Sexas. There's probably a group of about 10. Sexas looking fairly comfortable. He's not going to attack here, clearly a long way to go. Roglic, a little bit on his way. Introduce yourself, say your name and who you work for.
I'm Pierre Mergeau from L'Equipe, the French newspaper. It's for us already a big character for the front page also. So coming here with him, I knew I would have a little bit more work than last year's, but for the front page, I'm not the guy who decides, of course, but for the front page, I was a bit surprised also because we had, for example, Paris Saint-Germain, who was playing on Wednesday against Liverpool, Champions League. And what we did on Wednesday is that we had local front page in Paris talking about Paris Saint-Germain, but for the rest of France, it wasn't Paul Sexas. For us now, I think, Paul Sexas is already one of the biggest characters we have, one of the biggest sports star we have, like, for example, talking about cycling, like Pauline Ferrand-Prévot, who is the same category of character that the public loves and that the public want to read about.
So Aurélien, I know that a lot of people have been calling you Paul's father.
He spent all his time this week to play in one game on his iPhone. I don't know what is it, but he said, yeah. For me, the level he has now, for sure, we can say he can already win some stage in the Tour or to be in the top five. But yeah, for sure, we know that the Tour.
A picture, please.
Biggest thing maybe I learned, I would say it's more in the head, it's that you can do a day when you are exhausted in the end and take the start tomorrow and do it all over again. It's maybe the hardest thing.
The future is the future of Pogacar, maybe, and he's a French rider. So, Sunday morning, on my way to the airport, to Bilbao Airport. You
felt as though the future of the sport was being sort of re-scripted in front of your eyes.
So many hopes, so many tears, and all those so near going down through the years. But I still remember that magical day, Thibaut the Tourmalet, Mario screaming, Texas on the brain, Le Blaireau just beaming. 40 years of pain never stopped me dreaming. It's coming home, it's coming. Cycling's coming
home. Dentro de 600 metros, utiliza el carril derecho para tomar la rampa BI-631 en dirección Otsarkoaga.
Well, chaps, did you enjoy that?
I love the singing, Daniel. I love the singing.
Is this not
some time kind of attempt to sort of attract young listeners?
Well, I don't usually set Larry homework, but I did set him the homework of, as a homework assignment, to listen to that little package yesterday. He hasn't mentioned it. I think I can see him cringing on my behalf.
I have to say that the singing went on a bit long at the end. At first, I didn't know if that was actually supposed to be in there or if that was like an accident.
Jesus Christ. Are you not familiar with the song, though, are you, Larry? You don't, you know. We've established. You only know American sports.
Yeah.
Anyway, maybe we should explain for the listeners.
It was a song
about English football. You know more about that than me, Lionel. The English national football team, 1996. It became a bit of an anthem. And then we repurposed it only about 3 years ago. Ironically, 3 or 4 years ago, it was Thibaut Pinot's last season. And I had a hunch, I could feel it in my waters, that Thibaut Pinot was going to win the Tour de France on his last season as a pro rider. And as a bit of a joke that people were supposed to laugh at, I rewrote the song. Of course, the miracle didn't come to pass. But, you know, I feel it in my waters, chaps. And it was a very wet day on Sunday. We heard about that as well. Or Saturday. The last day of the Tour of the Basque Country was Saturday. There was a bit of a cameo as well from Primoz Roglic in that little package. Maybe we'll discuss that after we've got Sex Ass out of the way. I should also say that those 5 minutes, they're more or less a trailer for a much longer episode, which we will be releasing about my week in the Basque Country. The Week That Changed Pro Cycling, that's the subtitle. The title of the episode is going to be Sexy Basque.
Very good.
Did you get that reference, Lionel?
Very good, yes. Well, hopefully there'll be lots more singing.
Justin Timberlake song. Yeah, well, Larry, you were watching. We all know, I think, you know, you might have been one of the first people to talk about Paul Sexass on the Cycling Podcast years ago. You were obviously very familiar with his potential a long time ago. We followed it over the last few months. The start of this season had already been a bit of a breakthrough. And then we got a real, an even more emphatic breakthrough at the Tour of the Basque Country this week. He won, of course, the first two stages. Then he won a third stage later in the week. And he won the general classification convincingly by over 2 minutes. Larry, before I talk a bit more about Tour of the Basque Country last week, what did you make of it?
I mean, it was impressive, but I would say also unsurprising, just the way that he's been going so far this year. I guess to me, it was just a continuation of the season so far. So he just is showing again and again that he's just really next level. The crazy thing is I still think he probably has margin to progress, because from all my friends on the team, he's just a normal kid, you know, and while he's professional, he's not like this guy who's, you know, measuring every gram of his food. He's not, you know, he's not doing so much of the stuff that like a lot of the pros today are doing. So the scary thing is he probably still has margin to progress. So anyway, it was a really impressive week. It was an impressive performance, but yeah, unsurprising for me.
Yeah, obviously the talk of the week was his performance as well, but we get carried away very, very quickly when things like this happen, particularly in the current sort of context of the sport. you know, I found myself thinking about other times where I'd witnessed sort of firsthand this kind of coming of age moment, and people might laugh, but Damiano Cunego, when he won the Giro d'Italia in 2004, long, long time ago, that felt similar, because all of a sudden there was this period in that spring where he was just winning every race, and he wasn't nearly as young as Sexas, he was 22, but it felt as though he was going to dominate world cycling. He didn't. He did win that Giro d'Italia, but he didn't then go on to dominate professional cycling. We felt it again with Pogacar, but I was casting my mind back to 2019, and the sort of spectacular nature of Pogacar's 2019 season was almost lost a little bit in a general conversation. I remember a conversation we were having a lot at that point about a whole generation, a whole new wave of riders, because Bernal was about to win the Tour de France, and there seemed to be a lot of them. And we weren't necessarily sure at that point who was going to be the guy, who was going to be the sort of anointed one. This feels a bit different. Obviously, we've got the recent precedent of Pogacar. It feels different, but also similar to those previous occasions. So there was the performance in itself, which, as I say, was just resounding, emphatic. Then the two big question marks, the two big cliffhangers, which for those of us who were at the race, they were hotly debated and discussed throughout the week. Those being, is he going to do the Tour de France? Now, I can tell you that in the team, and unless you know different, Larry, they have not made a decision, and they're not going to make a decision until the night after Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And I believe them. Spoke to a lot of people, and I believe them. The second one is the question of his future. Now, he's got a contract until the end of 2027. There hasn't been a renewal. There hasn't been sort of, there haven't been rumours, strong rumours that a renewal is imminent. I spoke to his manager in the Basque Country, Yuna Lauca, former Festina professional, and he assured me there is not going to be any announcement of a renewal anytime soon. There have also been rumours of UAE's interest. They've been confirmed, in fact, by UAE's management. There have been rumours of other teams being interested, the likes of Ineos, I think even Visma. But that gave the week sort of even more intrigue, particularly this UAE rumour, not least because, so Paul Sexas' family was there the whole week, his mum and dad. His mum, incidentally, is a French teacher, like Pogacar's mum, but she's also French. His parents are both called Emmanuel, incidentally. His brother was there, Nino, who I think is 15. And it was reported a few weeks ago that, I think it was last year, UAE invited Nino to a training camp randomly. Seems slightly bizarre. If Decathlon had any concerns, any anxieties about UAE's interest in Paul in the future, it won't have been helped by the fact that all throughout last week until Saturday, when the family actually left because Nino had a race back in France, Nino was riding around the whole week on a UAE Colnago, just sort of circling the podium every day.
That's awesome.
Which I probably didn't please Decathlon too much. So this is really interesting. Then last week we also had these rumours, which the team denied, and they denied to me as well, about them possibly, and I think this was reported first by Wheeler Flitz, possibly racing with a Swiss licence from next year. Why would they do this? Because the French social security burdens, so tax burdens, but what tax, social security, are very, very onerous. What does this mean? That if a French team wants to sign a rider whose market value is 5 million, then French teams will have to pay out a lot more than a team from another country. Because they have to pay the rider's social security. So registering in Switzerland could be a way of getting around this. Now, as I say, the team have denied that they are going to do this. But Larry, I thought you could talk to this because you have personal experience of this. Even, you're a French resident, but as a foreigner, your former French team, so you rode for Decathlon, they will have had to pay your social security. So you'll know about this.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, the thing is, in France, what's super challenging for the teams is, let's just say the tax is so high. Now, that's social security contributions, but even just the employer, for example, he's going to get paid more than this. But let's just say Paul Sexas would get paid 1 million. the French, it's either they'd have to pay, essentially he'd cost them either 1.5 or 2 million because essentially they have to pay tax first and then he has to pay tax after. It's actually ridiculous. So a French team to have the equivalent budget of like a non-French team needs at least a 30% more money because that's how much extra tax there is. Everything I've heard is like they will switch the paying agent to Switzerland. Now, I'm 90% sure if they can, they'll stay registered in France because I think they still want to be a French team, an international team operating in France. But I think you can probably have a Swiss paying agent. I mean, if I recall on Aqua Blue, we were an Irish team and we had a British Virgin Islands paying agent. So I guess the paying agent can come out of wherever. But they already wanted to do this last year, like as in going into this season, but it didn't work out. It was too quick. So I assume they'll change the paying agent to Switzerland.
I believe you can only do that at the end of a promotion relegation cycle, in theory. They might have to wait 2 years or get some kind of exemption.
Well, definitely next year, they're going to have a paying agent in Switzerland from what I've heard. So whether that means the registration is going to change, I have no idea. But I'm pretty sure by next year, there'll be a Swiss paying agent. But then beyond that, what I've heard is I'm not sure if money is necessarily the deciding factor for success. You know, I know on the team, he has a lot of pressure being, you know, French in a French team, and it's a lot of pressure on his shoulders. Whereas if he was in UAE, he wouldn't be the, you know, he wouldn't even be the number one leader, right? So it'd be a little bit less pressure. You know, the problem is I know like Decathlon and the new boss definitely upset Yona, his agent, multiple times over the last couple of years because Yona used to be really, really close with Vincent Lavenu.
Yeah, I was going to say almost, well, if you wanted a contract with that team, just you used to just have to get Yona Lauker as your agent.
Exactly. So, you know, I know once Dominique Seres, the new boss, came in, that definitely shook things up. And I know he definitely made it a lot harder on Yona's riders, for example. There might be a little bit of bad blood between the two, so that might also make it more challenging. But I don't know. I'd be just more curious what Paul would want to do. Personally, I'd love to see him stay at Decathlon because I just think that'd be so cool. French rider, French team, and like taking on the world, you know? And now they've showed that they have had like super good support. He has a strong team. And I'm sure they'll build whatever around him. Also, I'm sure money isn't an issue because I'm 90% sure. I mean, Decathlon is enormous. And then CMA CGM is also enormous and came in specifically with the project of Paul Sexsauce in mind. We'll see. You know, I'm sure if they need more money, they'll put in more money. It's more just, I think it's going to come down to what Sexsauce wants. I don't know if you saw this, that perhaps Macron is getting involved. That I thought was awesome. I was like, imagine just getting a call from the president one day, like, you can't change teams, you know, for the Republic, you know?
So he has a relationship with, I get the acronym wrong all the time,
CMA CGM.
Yeah. CMA CGM. So there, you know, you can go online, you can see Macron showing up at their headquarters in Marseille. The French colleagues I've spoken to are still pretty skeptical about this. This was reported by Eurosport in Spain. It's sort of shades of the Italian Prime Minister Alcide De Gasperi calling up Gino Bartoli in the 1948 Tour de France, but, and telling him he needs to win.
Apparently, Macron already got involved with like Mbappe staying at like PSG and stuff like that. So I don't know, who knows?
Yeah, and there have been certain sort of changes to French tax laws that have been made, adopted with footballers in mind. Things like on the image rights on contracts and tax on image rights and so on and so forth. So yeah, maybe not beyond the realms of possibility. But Larry, just finally on the team, that was really nice to see last week that their riders, that, and this is the first French win in a stage race of that level, of sort of World Tour level, since Christophe Moore in the Dauphiné in 2007. So these are riders, and it's a team that is not really accustomed to being in this position where from the first day they have to defend the jersey. And, you know, guys like Prodhomme and who else was there, and Paris Pantron, they don't have an awful lot of experience of doing this. And you could see how excited they were and how energized they were every day. And it was actually just kind of heartwarming to see them with big smiles on their faces. Particularly, it's a long week. The Tour of the Basque Country is a really hard race, and you could feel towards the end of the week how tired the peloton was getting, but you saw these decathlon riders come over the line with big smiles on their faces and absolutely just couldn't wait to find out what Paul had done today. And that was a nice aspect of it, and it would be nice to see that team grow around him.
100%. You know, I mean, I think, like, if I think of the amount of times I did that race on that team and we just got smashed, you know, it's just so nice to see that, like, I you know, it's funny because someone asks, oh, what do you think, you know, you think he's just going to go and try to win every stage? I was like, no, probably not. But I'm 100% sure if he's in the possibility of winning a stage, they'll be like, go for it, you know, because it's like finally the shoe's on the other foot. So, you know, I thought that was cool to see. And yeah, it was nice.
Just on the financial aspect, though, chaps, I remember talking to Cedric Vasseur, who was at Cofidis at the time during the Tour de France last year, and he said that one of the biggest things holding back French cycling was this tax burden that the employment laws and the tax laws place on a French employer. Larry, you're broadly right on the percentages. Basically, for every £100,000 you pay in salary, it costs the team €142,500. So, you know, you can pay Paul Sexas for every €1 million, that's costing €1.425 million. So it's an expensive handicap that the French teams have, which other teams based and flagged in other countries don't face such hefty financial burdens. And you mentioned the co-sponsor CMA CGM. If you've ever been to Marseille, you can see their huge blue glass skyscraper standing sort of above the city. They are one of the world's biggest freight companies. They're in shipping, obviously. I wonder whether they're impacted at the moment by the Strait of Hormuz. I don't know whether they go there, whether they ship there, but the shipping industry probably facing some headwinds at the moment too. But interesting times with such a huge asset in Paul Sexas, potentially the man who could break this drought that French men's cycling has had. 1985 was the last French Tour de France winner, Bernard Hinault, of course, and he really does look like the real deal. And maybe we'll talk a bit more about him in the second part, or the next part, Daniel.
Third part.
Crikey.
So, chaps, the next date that we need to mark on our calendars is, I think it's the 26th of, although he'll be doing Flèche Wallonne before that, but 26th of April, Liège-Bastogne-Liège. That evening, I think Decathlon will decide that he's going to the Tour de France, and then it will be coming home. It will be coming home. Ça revient.
I would love to see him do the Tour de France.
I think he's got to. I mean, what have they got to lose, really? If he's fit and healthy, they can go in and sort of manage expectations, you know, on a rolling basis, really, can't they? I mean, there would be nothing wrong with doing the first 10, 12 days and just saying, yeah, that's enough for now for a 19-year-old. And,
that won't happen.
No, it won't happen. It won't happen. But it's a great fallback position, I would say, rather than keeping him out of it for another year and maybe, you know, doing the Vuelta and then, I don't know. I think
it's going to be a wild ride, though. It really is. I mean, on the last day, another thing that was great about last week, just watching him, was he has the same sort of swashbuckling style. Not aesthetically the way he looks on the bike, but in terms of attitude, in terms of aggression, the same as Pogacar. You know, he was leading comfortably after 2 days, and then he attacked on a descent the next day and tried to win again. And then on the final day in the rain, again, he was very aggressive and started to sort of go on the attack with 60k to go. And he did get caught, but there was a moment where he sort of turned to the camera and waved. And you could hear a sort of collective kind of intake, a disapproving sort of intake of breath from the French colleagues. And there were quite a lot of French journalists last week at the Tour of the Basque Country, more than there would ordinarily be for obvious reasons, 5 or 6 of them. And already there was a sort of a conversation about, oh, is he starting to look arrogant? And this was just, this is what it's going to be like. There's going to be the hysteria, there's going to be the questions about whether it's all too much, there's going to be the questions about whether he's too arrogant, and so on and so forth.
Oh, come on. I mean, breath of fresh air, really, in the fact that racing to win, and really, you know, Pogacar's kind of laid the groundwork for this. But I mean, that stage five that Sexas won, I mean, he really had Florian Lipovic for breakfast, lunch, high tea, dinner, midnight snack, didn't he? I mean, it was an extraordinary ride for somebody so young, you know, kind of ripped up all of the things we know about stage racing when...
That was him tired. That was him. That was him. Probably 75% of what he'd been on the first 2 days.
Yeah, and I mean, Lipovic could have been forgiven for thinking, well, surely I'll get the stage win here. That's got to be the deal, no? And
oh, absolutely. It's funny. the equivalent stage last year, infamously, was the one where Enric Mas and João Almeida came in together, and Enric Mas asked him, "Can I have the stage?" And Almeida told him where to stick it.
I like this. No gifts. I mean, you know, the infamous no gifts. But that Pogacar kind of set the level of expectation, really, or maybe raised the ceiling of what people who are this gifted think is possible. There's no kind of hiding in the shadows. There's no bluffing. There's no kind of waiting and seeing. It's just, let's lay it all out there and see. And I remember, Daniel, you made the point about Pogacar's breakthrough season in 2019. And I can remember that sense of not really knowing what we were dealing with. If you remember, he won the Volta ao Algarve at the start of the season. You know, he was prominent but didn't win at Itzulia. He won the Tour of California, which was, you know, very much in the shadow of the Giro in people's consciousness, maybe. And then he won those stages at the Vuelta. And it was a breathtaking kind of first season at elite World Tour level, having won the Tour de l'Avenir the previous year. Sexas is kind of already ahead of that, really. I mean, he's got a Pog-esque list of race results already this season, having finished second in Algarve, having won a stage, winning the Four Nordeste Classic, second at Strada Bianca, behind Pogacar, of course, and then, you know, dominating Itzulia, which is, as you say, Daniel, it's a really hard race. The terrain is difficult. And now we look forward to the Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège double, where, you know, he will be among the favourites. And you're quite right. I mean, if he does half decently in those two races, you would imagine that Decathlon will confirm that he'll ride the Tour de France, and they'll create a pathway to the Tour that gives him the best possible chance. But I think we're looking at something, and Larry, you've been a pro since when?
2013.
I mean, 2007 is another half a career before that, and that was the last time a French rider won a World Tour equivalent stage race.
That's insane.
Said Daniel, Christophe Moreau at the Dauphiné. And in that time, we've had Thibaut Pinot, we've had Romain Bardet. You know, they've finished on the podium of races. You know, they've done well at the Tour de France, finishing on the podium. Julian Alaphilippe, whose record in stage races is actually not terribly good. But Paul Sexas winning is for the nation of France is quite extraordinary, to, you know, break that long drought in men's cycling. And when you look at the last French winners of all of the major World Tour stage races, you really have to go back to Laurent Jalabert for most of them in the 90s. Paris-Nice was Jalabert, Catalonia Jalabert, Basque Country Jalabert, Romandie Jalabert, the Vuelta Jalabert, the Tour de France we know about, of course, Bernardino. But the big question is, you know, is Paul Sexas the successor to Laurent Brochard, the last Frenchman to win the Tour of Poland in 2002, Christophe Agnoluto, the last Frenchman to win the Tour of Switzerland in 1997, or Gilles Magnin, the last Tour of Down Under winner from France in 2000? I mean, already kind of exceeding that level of performance. But I think it puts into context the importance for the nation of the Tour de France, that they've got a rider that the expectations will be extraordinarily high, but not without justification. And we're talking about a 19-year-old.
I think also just beyond that, in terms of him doing it or not, I mean, if I'm Decathlon and this guy might leave my team, I'm going to then just get the max exposure I can, right? So, you know, for them, I mean, if they send him to the Tour de France, the amount of exposure is going to be insane. So it's like, if you have, you know, 2 years left with this guy, maybe even one. I don't know. Maybe someone else tries to buy him out, blah, blah, blah.
Imagine how many tents and gas canisters Decathlon are going to sell if they send him to the Tour de France.
So,
picnic tables.
I don't know. I just like they kind of have to do it, you know, especially if they might lose him. If they're like guaranteed to keep him, then I think, okay, fine. You can like not have him do the tour this year. But to me, it's still like, why not? You know, the other thing speaking about this whole season so far, it's just kind of funny because I remember last year about this time, you know, it was Tour of the Alps. He gifted this victory to Nico Prodom, and then Prodom went on to win like 5 races last year. And then Paul Sexas didn't win any. And everyone goes, oh, wow, I bet he regrets that, you know? And I was thinking this week, I'm sure he doesn't regret that at all, you know, having Prodom riding for him. And yeah, he's definitely won his fair share already this season. So yeah, cool to see.
Daniel, just to appeal to the kids, I mean, the Decathlon marketing team really ought to be getting Paul Sexas to record TikTok videos demonstrating every single sport that you can buy equipment for from Decathlon. There he is on a surfboard, a skateboard, a dartboard. There he is in gymnastics equipment. He's got his archery set, a volleyball, basketball.
Fortunately, at the moment, he's not really very active on social media, which will serve him very well if he can keep that up, I think.
But he's 19. What's my mind is blown.
I know. Well, the big highlight of my week was that I appeared, I mentioned every week, the Sexcast, the RMC radio cycling podcast. I was on it this week talking about Paul Sexas. Oh. So, that made
is it. Is Jerome Coppel one of the people on
he
it?
He is. I wasn't on with him. But chaps, the other thing we do need to talk about briefly, I talked about the cameo in my little postcard from the Basque Country. Bit of a cameo from Primoz Roglic. I guess you picked up on it, Larry. And one of these curious situations, one of these strange situations, sometimes when we're at races, particularly making something for the podcast like I'm making this week or we'll be making about the Tour of the Basque Country, we are recording just for sort of atmosphere. We're sort of standing there like lemons, holding up our recorders, trying to capture, you know, the applause, the PA system and so forth. And I was doing that before the last stage, start of the last stage. Primoz Roglic was standing close to me, sort of lining up in the, you know, ready to start. And then he came over for a chat. So I ended up recording stuff in a non-interview context because I was just trying to record the atmosphere. I ended up recording some fairly candid observations he had about how the team had ridden the previous day. You didn't hear them in that package, but it presented me with a little bit of a dilemma because just to go back to the previous day, so Lipovits and Roglic were second and third on general classification with 28 kilometers to go on the Thua climbs. This was the sort of queen stage. They, and in fact it was Jon Izagirre, were with Sexas. So Roglic sort of accelerated and Sexas caught him pretty easily. And then Lipovits accelerated. Sexas accelerated first and Lipovits followed him. And off they rode. Lipovits didn't do a whole lot of work, but he did do a bit, certainly when they got over that climb, sort of on the descent and then onto the final rise, and then Lipovits was certainly working at the end. For a long time, Roglic was with Javier Roma from Movistar, not very far behind. It was a bit of a curious tactic. It was also the body language between them was kind of curious at the end because Roglic came over the line. He sort of high-fived Lipovits, but it seemed quite tense. So fast forward to the next morning, it's about to start pouring with rain. Roglic comes over for a chat, asks me, am I watching ski jumping? I tell him, no, I'm watching the Arsenal game. We start chatting and the conversation sort of naturally flows into the previous day. And you didn't hear that. And you're not going to hear that. And I had this conversation with Lionel earlier. But Larry, what do you make of this when I describe this scenario? Should I be disclosing any of this?
Is it fair game?
I think it's
you're,
fine.
You're stood there in
fine.
An accredited area. You've got your recorder.
Okay, well, Primoz wasn't too happy. And it was kind of interesting because what I did gather from the conversation, I'm not going to paraphrase too much, I'm certainly not going to quote him, he's finding it quite hard not to be riding for the win. not to be racing for the win. And this was a scenario where the previous day where he thought they might try something a bit like what Vingegaard and Roglic did to Pogacar on the Galibier in the Tour de France in 2022, wasn't it? 2022? Yeah, I think it was 2022. However, if you go back and watch the footage, if you haven't got the legs, Roglic just didn't really, to be honest, seem to have the legs to do that, because it requires you to have enough power in the legs to accelerate fast and then the other guy accelerate fast and to wear out the leader, which would have been Sexas in this case, that way. But he just didn't quite, his legs just couldn't quite cash that check, I would suggest. But it's an interesting scenario in that team. Very interesting.
I was going to say, I think also that climb's so hard that, you have to have the legs to attack. And I don't think they would have dropped Sexas. And then it's just kind of all for nothing, because then they'd also blow themselves, which, Roglic ends up getting dropped anyway. Then, on the other hand, I do think, when you saw it, Leipowitz, he didn't take a pull for a really long time. It was only in the end. And then he pulled very little. I'm sure he was even slowing down Sexas when he pulled through. I actually think, he did play pretty much the, I have a teammate behind card, but Roglic just wasn't coming back.
I wanted this. And after my little chat with Primoz, I did go back to check the footage just to make sure I was remembering this right. And I agree with you, Larry. I don't think Lipovic did too much wrong.
No. I don't think so. And I think in the end, then it's just kind of in that scenario, it's so hard to not pull. You know what I mean? Already he's going, I'm not pulling. Then at the end, he does a few token pulls, which I think in the end is not
it. Is dropping back an option, though? Is not going with Sexas and dropping back?
The thing is then what if he gets caught by everyone and then neither of them even end up on the podium, 100% Leipowitz needed to stay with Sexas.
And if Lipovic had managed to pull off the stage win, that would have been the perfect. The fact that he couldn't do that was.
He probably shouldn't have started his sprint at 800 meters from the line if he really wanted to win, He probably could have played that a little bit better, but anyway.
But then Roglic lost 20-odd minutes on the last day. So,
well, that added a further layer of intrigue, Lionel, because the weather was absolutely foul. 60 riders pulled out. And it was a bit of a circuit as well, so there was ample opportunity. That was why there were so many abandons, I think. There was ample opportunity for people to pull out. And Roglic, although he was dropped very early in the day, he finished 23 minutes down, which I thought was to his credit, but also a little bit curious.
Lipovic was he was the more consistent over the week, wasn't he, really? Just a couple of other things from the Basque Country, Daniel, Ineos Grenadiers had a good week with two stage wins, one for Axel Lawrence, one for Andrew August. They rode well.
I spoke to Andrew August on the last morning and I did that terrible thing. We were talking about this the other day. We were in last week's episode. We were talking about how hard it was to go to riders and ask them about other riders. And I'd gone to Andrew August in the morning of the final stage and reminded him that in the Valmore Tour in 2024, I think it's one of the big junior races, he and Paul Sexas were 1 and 2 and they were pretty inseparable. On the mountain stages, it was, well, I think August won the race overall, but it was those two who were clearly better than everyone. And we talked about that. And we talked about whether Paul Sexas was a bit of an inspiration for him. And the sort of subtext to the question being, well, Sexas now is miles ahead of you. And then Andrew August won the final stage.
That was actually a sick win. That was really cool to see.
Yeah, and the other rider that really caught the eye on that final day in the break was Tobias Halland Johannesson of Uno X, who was in that break. I think it was over 100K, wasn't it, break that they were in. And he climbed up to third place overall as a result of being in that break behind Lipovic and the winner Sexas, of course. The other thing I wanted to ask Larry about was, did you see or hear anything about the two crashes, incidents involving race vehicles There was
Mika Just Landa. I saw the Landa, yeah, but I didn't crashed, see the other one.
Caused, exacerbated by the race doctor's car.
And then I heard they couldn't find the race doctor. I don't know, though.
And then Kim Anderson of Little Trek, he got a fine for driving into the wheel of Markel Beloki.
Yeah. I don't know if it was Bodon or Beloki. I did see that, but he didn't crash, right?
No.
Yeah, that was impressive that he didn't crash. But
a couple of quite high-profile incidents there. And the other notable thing, especially with the Ardennes Classics coming up, Isaac Del Toro crashed out on stage 3, didn't he, Daniel?
He did, and won't be taking part in the Ardennes Classics, will he?
Oh, really? Wow. Okay.
No. Should we talk briefly about what's coming later this week? Because we are sort of switching our focus away from the cobbles. We have got the Brabantse Pale on Friday, and then we've got Amstel Gold, and then next week, of course, it's Flesh and Liège. And Brabantse Pale, just wanted to mention, Lionel, on that, this week there was some really shocking news about former three-time winner Oscar Freire, who on this podcast, well, we featured him numerous times. I've spoken to him numerous times at the Vuelta and featured him here. And we've always talked about him in glowing terms because he always comes across as an incredible, sort of incredibly affable chap. And I think most people in cycling see him that way. Well, earlier this week, it was reported in Spain that he'd been arrested for harassment of his wife. Essentially, or on suspicion of harassment, I think that's the correct translation, there was a very quick, not really a trial, but he admitted that he was guilty of what he was being accused of, or at least some of it, and he was given a restraining order for 6 months and a 9-day house arrest, essentially. Just a story that, I mean, in cycling over the years, there have been many stories that have just completely sort of knocked you sideways. And that was one of them, certainly regarding someone like Oscar Freire, who, as I said, his reputation certainly was that of a very sort of mild-mannered and universally liked former rider. But I was speechless reading about that. So former Brands Appeal winner Oscar Freire, we've got that on Friday, and then on Sunday is Amstel Gold. I must confess, chaps, I was so focused, I had such tunnel vision on the sex ass beat that I really neglected my responsibility to talk to the likes of Skelmoza, defending champion last year, find out how he's feeling and looking before Amstel Gold, and I didn't really talk to anyone much about Amstel Gold. So yeah, Larry, over to you.
Honestly, I haven't even paid any attention. I know on my team, it'll be Mark Hirschi and Julian Alaphilippe. So hopefully Julian can do his attack that he did last year in the final rather than with 100K to go.
Your boys were all sick. Your boys were all sick in Basque Country. They all got a stomach bug.
The highlight of the team performance. I think we had one finisher in the end or something. So not ideal.
Yeah, just on Brabantse Pale, which is on Friday, Daniel, they've moved the date. Last year, they moved it from the Wednesday to the Friday, and that had really good impact because we saw Remco Evenepoel, who was making his seasonal debut that day, beat Wout van Aert at the finish. Neither of those riders are taking part this year. There's no Tom Pidcock either. It's a little bit of a watered-down field. I know it's not a World Tour race, but it's a good race. It's a literal transition from the cobbles to the Ardennes-style classics, isn't it? Because there are some cobblestone sections and there's some steep hills that you associate more freely with the likes of Amstel and Liège.
It is a World Tour. Oh, but sorry, we're talking about Brabantse. Sorry, Lionel.
We're talking about Brabantse Pale. Sorry. So I'm gonna break the habit of a lifetime. I think Romain Grégoire will win that.
Oh, that's good. I think it's a good pick.
Then Amstel Gold. I mean, is he in the top 100 though, Larry? Am I allowed to pick him?
He's definitely in the top 100. Yeah, so.
Oh well. But then we'll see Remco Evenepoel at Amstel Gold. Skelmoser, as you mentioned, the defending champion, Daniel. Ben Healy, EF Education. Kevin Vauclin.
It was a bit out of sorts in Basque Country. Healy, he had a crash on the first day when he was reconning the prologue course, and then he tried a few times, including on the last day, and didn't come off for him. But yeah, I would suggest that he'll be one of the favourites, definitely.
Tom Pidcock as well for Pinarello Q36.5. We'll be back early next week to talk about what happened at Amstel Gold Race, won't we, Daniel? And then there'll be an Arrivé from Flèche Wallonne to be won by Paul Seksas, and then an Arrivé from Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which will be won by Tadej Pogacar ahead of Paul Seksas. And there'll be Arrivé episodes for the women's races, which are much less predictable at the moment, I would suggest.
Yeah, we might have Sexy Basque next week. That might come out at some point next week as well. Lineup, but I need to discuss that with you.
Is there a sort of listener's advisory?
There is singing.
I mean, it's got a slightly risque title, and it's got your singing in it, which is, I mean, that deserves some kind of warning for the listeners. But
maybe I'll have to give the listeners a remix of the same song, because I didn't record it multiple times, unfortunately. Yeah, that's something to look forward to. Larry, you're at the Tour of the Alps next week, a race I always look forward to. One of my favourite parts of the world, up in Südtirol and up in Austria as well. How's your form, Larry? How are you feeling? How are you looking?
We'll see, you know. You never really know at altitude. Sometimes you feel good at altitude, then you feel bad at sea level, bad at altitude, good at sea level. So I'm just hoping we've been training well. We've been, doing everything right. So I hope I'll feel good at Tour of the Basque. I think
Tour of the Alps, hopefully.
Tour of the Alps, yeah, hopefully. Yeah, yeah. I think our boy Michael Storer is in good shape. So
defending
maybe we
champ.
Can recreate last year.
Yeah, defending champ. Pressure's on, Larry.
Yeah. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to that. Anything else, Lionel?
Oh, very last word, really. Should mention Tim Malia, because he won Skelder Price before Paris-Roubaix and then followed up with the Ronde van Limburg as well for Soudal Quick-Step. A bit of a slowish start for Soudal Quick-Step in terms of the World Tour. Anyway, they're waiting for their first World Tour win. But Tim Malia got a couple of big race victories there at the next level down, and O Gran Camino, which is going to finish probably in about 25 minutes or so. The stage goes to Padrón today. Is that the Padrón Peppers?
It is.
Is that where the little peppers come from? Oh, very nice, very nice. Up there in the northwest of Spain. And we'll try and recap all of these kind of, everything that's going on this week in the episode early next week.
A couple of other race winners I wanted to mention as well. Tour de la Loire last week, won by Antoine Lott of Decathlon, but we're not supposed to have favourites on the podcast. Larry is the only rider we really are sort of partisan towards on the podcast, but sort of a bit of a favourite of mine, Alexander Kamp. Well done to him for winning the penultimate stage. That's about it, I think. We didn't mention Peo Bilbao retiring at the end of the year, but he's got a few months left for Peo. We did hear from him earlier saying that Paul Seksas was playing with everyone. Anyway, we'll be back at the weekend. Not the weekend, early next week. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Daniel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.